Colleagues, thank you. Welcome to the Beyond Compliance 2014 Ethics and Integrity Research Showcase. My name's Julie Willis. I'm the Pro Vice Chancellor of Research Capability, and part of my portfolio is to oversee ethics and integrity in research for the university. I'd like to begin today's symposium by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, both past and present. In 2013, ORI offered for the first time development funding for a range of activities in research ethics and integrity. The resultant research ethics and integrity development grants are a key component to enhancing the culture of research ethics and integrity at the university. 20 applications were received from across the university. An assessment group drawn from members of the Research Ethics and Integrity Strategy Committee ranked applications and recommended to fund 6 projects to a total of $50,000. Funding was provided via the Sir William Brunton Memorial Fund, which was set up for the promotion of research and is held in trust by the university. We're delighted to host all 6 funded projects today. This event showcases funded projects, demonstrate that research ethics and integrity are active, living principles that extend beyond compliance. Speakers have been asked to provide us with a 5 to 7 minute presentation. We've got 10 minutes in total, so we've been very lucky. There might just be time for questions at the end of each presentation. All these presentations will be recorded and made available on the ORI website, and you'll be delighted to know that lunch follows this event from 1:15. So I'd like to call on our first group of presenters, Mr. Peter Ferguson and Ms. Raylene Nixon, who come from the Rural Health Academic Centre and the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences, and they have come down from Shepparton especially for this presentation today.
G'day, my name's Peter Ferguson. I'm a Yorta Yorta traditional owner.
And I'm Raylene Nixon. I'm an Aboriginal woman from southwest Queensland and I belong to the Goongri people.
Before we begin, we'd like to also pay our respects to Wurundjeri and their elders, any past and present. Thanks. So we applied for a grant a couple of years ago, and it was to develop a Yorta Yorta Ethics Advisory Committee. Rural Health has been really supportive and very happy with the money that we were able to get from ORI, the Office of Research and Ethics and Integrity. You'll have to pardon me, I'm really nervous, I'll say. We applied for a grant and got about 11 or 12,000, I think it was. We were able to use that money within Rural Health to get a little bit more money. I think we got about $20,000, which allowed us to appoint Raylene part-time as a project officer to drive the Yorta Yorta Ethics Committee, the establishment of the Yorta Yorta Ethics Committee. So that's a really exciting innovation and part of a suite of things that Rural Health is currently doing in CHEP. Just to give a bit of background quickly, what's named to Shepparton? Shepparton, Yorta Yorta Country is, as you can see by the diagram, Echuca is one of the major regional centres, and Shepparton is just to the south of there, which is another large regional centre. We number probably about 6,000 out of about 60,000 locally, so we're roughly about 10% of the population, and at the moment we have there's a lot of research done in Shep, but a lot of the research isn't done with the Aboriginal community particularly in mind. It's done off to the side of the Aboriginal community. It's done on the Aboriginal community. We've got a slide later on that will help us explain that a little bit closer. So what we're trying to do with the establishment of the Ethics Committee is to... it's about the vertical integration of an Aboriginal worldview. And it's just not about being key informants in someone else's research, but it's about being involved in the entire research process.
So Aboriginal people are among the most highly researched in the country, and we are now in a position to assert the Aboriginal perspective on research and to have a voice in the research process. So the establishment of the Yorta Yorta Community Ethics Advisory Group in partnership with RAC, HEAG and the Aboriginal community is just the first step for us. Our long-term goal would be to establish a Yorta Yorta Community Ethics Committee by itself, which is outside this application. So historically, Western knowledge has advanced into Aboriginal people's communities with little regard for the notions of Indigenous worldviews and philosophical frameworks that underpin the Aboriginal community life.
Recently, you had an example about ICE, the research that was done on ICE?
Just for example, we attended a conference probably a couple of months ago now where research had been conducted in the Shepparton community on ICE, and the presenter conducted his research obviously on ICE users but presented it in a way that indicated that all 14-year-old girls in our community were selling themselves for ICE, and that doesn't portray what we believe is real in our community.
Yeah.
So this is just pointing out the difference between Western research cycle and an Aboriginal research cycle. So the inclusion of Aboriginal community-driven research empowers the research cycle through the recognition of overlapping relationships within the Aboriginal communities. So if you just have a look at the Western research cycle at the top, identifying the research area in the design, we think that research within an Aboriginal worldview fails there. Research in communities is impacted and diverges when researchers get to hear they are using Western philosophical views that can have a conflicting point of view. However, the way a researcher and an Aboriginal community view the world is usually different. So we have critiqued the Western research cycle to enable the implementation of differing views and philosophical, and not only those that operate solely from a Western standpoint within the Indigenous community.
Just say anything, Russ. We're saying, and in the there are a lot of decisions that are made, like at the identifier research area and the design in a research project. There are lots of decisions made there that are made with a Western, with a Western lens in mind. What's his name? And I think that's an area where an Aboriginal ethics committee can help incorporate an Aboriginal worldview into research. I think one of the things that is missed in a lot of that sort of stuff is the nuance that is a part of Aboriginal communities. We're saying, if you don't understand the language and the body language and you don't understand the underpinning stuff, they're the sorts of things that you need to include in that process. A lot of the research to date, like Rail's example suggested, has been about a small subset that is used then to talk about the whole, and it's never quite representative of who we are and what we are. In the second diagram, you can sort of see that there is a lot more going on in Aboriginal community sort of stuff, or so, and that's the sort of thing that we'd like to capture and incorporate, which I think will deliver a better research outcome.
So what we're aiming to do is have research where Aboriginal people control their own agenda that respects the spiritual and philosophical foundations that provide the platform from which Aboriginal research activities should be considered.
We're looking around to try and get an idea of a diagram that might just sort of present the picture. And it sort of seems to me that that where Western research methodologies are, they operate on that part of Aboriginal world. And it's sort of about trying to make the rest of us fit into that little space. And it's never going to happen. I was trying to find a square hole, but we couldn't find one. But this is like, you know, there's a whole lot going on underneath the surface that is not captured, is not incorporated, you know, and then, you know, a lot of the research is then used to underpin policy. Like recently, we've had a welfare quarantine in Shep sort of thing. What's his name? Community wasn't asked about it. It was just there was research done elsewhere. There's a big Aboriginal community in Shep with a large infrastructure. Let's give that a whirl and see if it goes there. What's his name? Like it's just like trying to fit that iceberg into a square hole. It's just about the knowledge context of one culture cannot be fully understood by another. So the Yorta Yorta Ethics Advisory Committee seeks to... Just scroll it down, please, Rose.
I don't know.
Engage and utilise the knowledge and base of the local Aboriginal community and empower the community to comment on research that occurs in their local community. Just to give an example of something that if you don't understand the nuance, it gets lost on you, is one of our great elders, Bill Onus, was asked about a name for a particular festival in Melbourne, and he was asked that question on the back of being knocked back for some local activity that he was after the government to fund. Because that was knocked back, when they asked him for the name for the festival, he said, why don't we call it Moomba? What's that? Because it means this or that. Well, Moom is actually this part of a man's body. So he was having a lend of the researcher. But that's the point I'm trying to make about it. If you don't capture the nuance, you're not doing it justice. At first glance, it would appear that culture and ethics are unrelated. However, subconsciously, our perspectives are influenced by values that they have derived from our cultural heritage. It becomes a matter of ethics when the resolution of cultural and value differences and conflicts is made to the advantage of one party and to the disadvantage, harm, and distress of another. This is a really exciting process for us. We're saying at the moment we've got a Masters in Health Social Science that we're delivering. We've got a lot of infrastructure in SHEP. Raylene is one of our girls who has just graduated from a Masters in Health Social Science, which was completed via video conference into Parkville classes, and we are building a research team. The development of the ethics program is one of the tranche of things that we can do to develop a research-ready and involved Aboriginal community. And I think that's a really exciting thing for SHEP as we go forward, for Yorta Yorta as we go forward. No worries, thanks.
So, Tom, any burning questions? It sounds the most fantastic initiative. I'm really pleased.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for the money.
I'd like to invite up our next presenter, which is Associate Professor Peter Mansell from the Faculty of Veterinary and Agricultural Sciences. I'll let you introduce this, Peter. You can tell us what Crook Moo needs.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you very much for the opportunity to tell you what Crook Moo means. Obviously, because we're all Australians, I'm assuming everybody clearly knows what Crook Moo means initially. We have some international collaborators who have no idea what we're talking about, but that's okay. Crook Moo is a project which was funded through ORI, partially funded through ORI last year, done by myself, Dr. David Beggs, and Sarah Franklin, who's here as well. We're from the new Faculty of Veterinary and Agricultural Sciences, and we're all cow people. The basis behind this project is that the clinical examination of a cow for a cattle veterinarian, is a fundamental skill. You can't be a cattle veterinarian without the ability to do a good clinical examination. But teaching students and young veterinarians how to do that clinical examination can be extraordinarily stressful and carries a whole heap of baggage attached to it. It can be stressful for the client. Most of the training that our students do with sick cows is on commercial properties. So we're dealing with stressed farmers, farmers who are working in a commercial environment. So there's a lot of baggage that goes along underneath there. So the clients are stressed. The patients are stressed. Although I'd have to say one nice thing about working with cows is they don't show their stress very much. They're remarkably stoic and they just look at you until they can't take it anymore. And then they kick your head off. And it's also very stressful for the student. A lot of our students have little background in rural industries. They're finding themselves in a very stressful environment dealing with uncooperative patients, intimidating clients, often in unpleasant or sometimes downright dangerous circumstances. So we want the students to be able to practice the clinical examination process, not the actual hands-on, the physical skills, but the thought process, the routine of going through a clinical examination of a cow. And we want them preferably to do that without needing a cow to do it on. There are obviously some major practical constraints in having to have a sick cow to practice on. You can't always find a sick cow when you want one. We want them to be able to practice those skills in a variety of cases. So giving them exposure to exotic disease, which we don't have in Australia, or uncommon diseases. A lot of our students are Generation X or Y or Z or whatever we're up to now. And they like doing things late at night. Lots of my students send me emails at 2 o'clock in the morning and then ask me at 9 o'clock in the morning why I haven't replied yet. So they would like the ability to work on this in their own time. And the most important thing behind this is to try and give them a learning experience without those unhelpful stresses of the intimidating client, the uncooperative patient, and the inexperienced student who's trying to sort their way through learning theoretical, methodological sort of stuff at the same time as they're trying to make sure that they don't get injured by something that weighs 600 kilos. So what is CrookMoo? CrookMoo is it's a computer program. It runs in Windows. It's networkable. It's integrated bovine case material. It's only cows at the moment because we're cow people. It takes text, image, sound, video, rolls it into one. It's user-initiated free text, so the student user drives the whole process. It's a simulation. They type in what they want to know about this cow, and the computer sits there and waits for them to say something. There's no drop-down lists or push buttons or anything like that. It works on text recognition, keywords, and so if the student doesn't enter something, nothing happens. It's just like real life. If you stand there looking at a farmer long enough, nothing will happen. It's realistic because we introduce things like sequence, age, gender, reality checks. I'll describe that in a minute. And they can select clinical pathology and necropsy, the clinical examination of dead animals, but there are obviously consequences to that. So a little brief tour. This is what it looks like, and you're not really expected to read what's on the screens, but just get an idea. The student starts over, if I can move my mouse, over here. There's some help, which none of them read. And then there's starting doing cases, so they can select from a variety of cases. We've got 20 or 30 cases in there. We're using some of the ORE money to assist us to build up that, and we're also collaborating with some overseas universities to get some international cow cases. So they can select their cases. They then go in, they get provided with some pictures or video or something and some history, and then the computer sits and looks at them until they ask what they want to do. So this user up here has asked to collect some urine, and they get shown a picture of the urine. This is what the urine looks like. And they can take the temperature and they can listen to the heart and all those sorts of things. They can take blood samples, but as in the real world, if you take blood samples from a cow in the paddock, you generally don't have a clinical pathology laboratory in your car. So we will report the clinical pathology results, but we wait and force them to wait for that to come back, which they find extraordinarily frustrating, but that's okay. Eventually, having done their clinical examination, they have to enter a diagnosis. The reality checks, the computer is clever enough to work out that they're dealing with, in this case, a bull. So if they ask to palpate the uterus of this bull, they will be told in no uncertain terms that he doesn't have one. If they try and do things to little animals that they can't do, they will be told that it's a little animal. If they do things in a silly order, so if they do something very interventionist, like sticking their hand in the rectum of their animal, which is what we do for a living, that generally puts the heart rate up, and so they'll get told off for doing that. So they get a case report. This gives them some automated feedback on what they've done wrong, how they've done things incorrectly, what they've done correctly, and what the final result was. And then they can move on. The trick, I suppose, in this project a little bit is that we've set it up so that the case data is completely separate to the programming. We have visions of this being able to be converted into something other than CrookMoo. It could be CrookHorse, it could be CrookChook, it could be Crook, you name it. It could potentially be CrookPerson. But we can do that without reprogramming it. It can all be done by an inexpert author like myself. So we have grand visions of this. At the moment, we're just playing with cows and working our way through that. I would very much like to acknowledge the support that we've had from ORE. We've had funding support from a number of places, but the ability to get support from sometimes unexpected sources is very much appreciated. I'm conscious of time. If anybody wants to actually play CrookMoo, I'll be around. Look, I've got it on the computer here. If you want to come and have a play, that's fine by me. If there are questions, that's fine, but if you want to keep them until later on, that's fine by me too. So thank you very much.
An offer you can't resist is getting to play with CrookMoo. I'd like to invite up our third presenter, which is Professor David Storey of the Melbourne Medical School. We'll be talking about the survey approval process for ATREC.
Thanks, Julie. Okay, good afternoon and thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm David Storey. I'm the Foundation Chair of Anaesthesia here at the University of Melbourne. For those of you who are a bit uncertain as to what anaesthetists actually do, we are medical specialists who keep people alive during surgery. It's probably the best way to describe what we do. I head a unit called the Anaesthesia Perioperative and Pain Medicine Unit, and we have a particular interest, and I was looking very much at the crook moo, because a major part of anaesthesia is preoperative assessment and risk management of patients prior to surgery. I'm also, through my role as a clinical anaesthetist and clinical researcher, involved with the trials group of the Australian New Zealand College of Anaesthetists, which is the world's leading anaesthesia and perioperative medicine research group. We conduct very large studies which are published in major journals. Now, one of the issues in conducting large multi-centre studies is approval by hospital human research ethics committees. And in this setting, I will use the term ethics to mean both research ethics and governance. Increasingly, the ethics is simpler and the governance is worse. And one of the major issues is the apparent diversity in approaches that ethics committees take. And so with the support of ORI, which we're very grateful for, both in terms of both a collaborative research project but also for the funding, we want to survey human research ethics committees. I couldn't resist calling it the Shrek study. So the from a medical perception, and these are actual quotes, that I have a colleague who will never ever do research again because he found it, his research experience or ethics experience, so horrible. I had a neurosurgeon say to me the other day, who would do research because of ethics? And I'm not kidding you. And below is a quote from me about 10 years ago. The issue we have is that there is ethics is seen as a major hurdle. We all recognise the need for protection of patients and participants, but it can be a very difficult procedure. So as part of my role, I'm engaged with the 14 hospitals affiliated with the university, and we wish to undertake multi-centre research across a number of areas of interest. And the one of the major strategies that the university wishes to undertake is greater clinical multi-centre trials. And in fact, through the offices of the School of Medicine, the School of Population Global Health, and with support from a body known as MCRIC, on collaborative research platform. We have a new platform within the university called MCATS, or the Melbourne Clinical and Translational Sciences Platform. So we have a new body that aims to promote multi-centre research. Part of that will be the governance and research component. So we're very interested in what the various ethics committees of these different hospitals do. And I guess asking how much of a barrier is this, or is it a barrier? So what we've done is to, as a joint project with ORI, is to set up a series of scenarios, a bit like SICMU in a sense, and we're going to look at increasing complexity, and I'll talk about the scenarios in a moment, and do a face-to-face survey with the chairs and the administrators of the health ethics committees around, affiliated with the hospital, to look at their approaches to these different scenarios. So these are increasing degrees of difficulty, intervention and patient involvement. So the first is a relatively straightforward retrospective audit of staff aureus or golden staff in hospitals. So this is purely bringing data out of patient records. And this is a very common type of research and is usually regarded as low risk. The next is an observational study of clinical practice. So patients need to be observed, their data recorded prospectively. And this is the sort of research that I've frequently been involved in, looking simply at the fluids we use during moderate surgery, that is elective hip and knee replacements. The next is more complex again. It is an interventional study. And this is similar to a study we're actually doing at the moment. So patients are getting the fluids we routinely use, but in a randomised way. And this adds to a further degree of complexity. I think one of the interesting things at the moment is that for patients in phase four studies, those who are in the usual care arm are often found to do better than those who are in usual care outside the study. And this is part of a new paradigm in large multi-centre studies, that the assumption has been from the through the development of ethical statements across the last 50 years since the Second World War, that there's a degree of risk for patients or participants in research. One of the changes now is there is some suggestion that actually being within research studies enhances the safety of patients, and this may well be associated with greater surveillance intervention. For example, our research nurses are usually highly qualified intensive care nurses who are out on the wards keeping a closer eye on the patients. And so this is a bit of a paradigm shift in aspects of human research ethics. But then we go back to a more traditional study that, traditional in the sense that it is early on, it's a phase two, that is, you know, relatively soon in the intervention, and patients may be at risk. And so it's a randomised post-operative high-powered magnets for patients with glioblastoma, which for those who don't know, that is a very nasty brain tumour. And the final one incorporates increasingly what is occurring in clinical research with translational work into molecular and other biological markers, particularly associated with cancer. So we have five scenarios. We want to ask the ethics committees what they do. So we think the benefits will be to identify the similarities and differences between the HREX associated with the university, the opportunity to see what people do and perhaps look at the strengths and weaknesses, and that there are increasingly bodies that we can collaborate with, including the newly reformed Victorian Consultative Council on Clinical Trials Research, and we hope to publish this. So currently the grant has been awarded, we've refined the scenarios, we've appointed a research assistant, we're currently in ethics, which hasn't gone quite as smoothly as we would have liked, I think because of a communication misunderstanding on our part. So I'd just like to go on to say it's important that this is a team sport, that everything we do, the research teaching engagement, I'm increasingly convinced that the three parts of the University of Melbourne strands are all important. That from our point of view, we want to work with different medical groups to convince them of the importance of collaboration. So in our world, this is particularly with surgeons, our intensive care colleagues, and internal medicine or general medicine. But with MCATs, we have new partners, biostatistics, health economics. Research governance is going to be an important part from the university point of view, that we provide expertise so when people go to ethics committees, go to governance, they're already prepared for what is required, particularly in the area of contracts. And Fernando and his group with health informatics are playing an important role. We do have to deal with hospital administration. This is a clinician's view of hospital administration. I was interested, the word centre here is used a bit like admin in hospitals. Allied health professionals, including nurses, pharmacists and physiotherapists. Remembering it is all about the patients, however. It is about improving outcomes for patients. And as we've talked about today, including our Indigenous friends, that we want people to be able to take part in research in a way that is safe and appropriate for them. And I emphasise the word appropriate, including culturally appropriate. And always remember the anaesthetists. Thank you.
We now move on to our fourth presentation, which will be from Dr. Kylie Smith and Ms. Margaret Cody from the Youth Research Centre at the Melbourne School of Graduate Education. Can I ask Margaret?
Okay, I'm sorry we haven't got any pictures of cows or even of ethics committees, and there are certain ethical problems about putting photos of children in too, so we'll go without photos, I'm afraid. Kylie is here with me, and I'm Margaret Cody, giving the actual account of it. The title of our presentation, Ethical Engagement in Research with Children Under 5 Years of Age. Now, there are plenty of people doing such research around the university and in many universities across the world and in very many different disciplines, which was one of the very interesting things about the research. But there isn't very much account here of the actual ethics of researching on such children. There's a great deal on the ethics of researching children generally, but there are a number of problems or questions that can be asked about researching with children under five, even though there are so many people actually doing it. One of the things that made us want to do this is the changes that have occurred in looking at children over the last three decades. They've affected these changes, which have looked at the child as less of a passive object of research and more as a participant in research and as a contributor to the research, has affected the way research has been done in areas like medicine and physiotherapy, as well as in education, social research generally. And so they are across many different disciplines. There's also been the rise in participatory research in many disciplines, and that's had its effect in research with children under five. There's also been challenges to particular paradigms of research, the idea of the young child being defined by the various stages that it's going through has been challenged, and that's had an effect on what we think, how we think a child should be treated. There are a number of official documents which have been influential in this, the primary one being the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which was ratified by every nation except Somalia and the US. And in the US, it actually is still taken extremely seriously. And that document is notable for Article 12, which recognises the child's right to be heard. For early childhood, the second document is also very important because that's applying the convention to early childhood, to children under seven. And the general comment says that it notes the growing body of theory and research which confirms that young children are best understood as social actors whose survival and well-being and development are dependent on and built around close relationships. So it's stressing the idea of the very young child as being a social actor. There's also a big literature on the topic, and there are, as you might expect, various tensions in the literature. There are general acceptances of the changes that have taken place over those decades, but there are questions being asked, such as can the very young child really freely assent? And the phrase school docility has been spoken of by Gallagher and Gallagher as a challenge to those who are working with very young children. Another question is, are the benefits of participation for child researchers being used to outweigh and mask serious ethical difficulties? There's an ethicist at this university who queries this, particularly in medicine, that if the benefits, and I was interested in, David was talking about the benefits to the participants, can they actually, if you stress that, does that mask actual ethical difficulties? And the last one there is participatory research with very young children, tokenistic at best, or even perhaps a sham. That's not my view, but it is a challenge that's been thrown to us. What we did was look at these research methodologies and protocols which are being used by researchers from a variety of disciplines widely through Australia and internationally, who are people who are actually working with or researching with children under five. We undertook a survey and asked we're going to still in the process of organising interviews with a number of the people who answered the survey and said they would be happy to be interviewed. And these are the questions where we asked, or the broad questions we asked. What conditions is it appropriate to involve children under 5 years of age as active participants in research and evaluation? What data collection tools are most appropriate? And what protocols ensure the ethical engagement of such children? The survey, we went through the standard elements in research ethics, which are known by everybody, the assent or consent in case of adults, confidentiality, harm and benefit, and so on. And in some cases, we gave prompts to within the survey to get people to respond to them. For example, there's an English writer who's written about a great deal about the ethics of research with young children and asks how we can understand the question of children contributing to research. She suggests four levels: to be informed, to form and express views, to actually influence a decision, or to be the main decider about proposed treatment or care. And in some research, children can go to level four. In other research, they wouldn't go beyond level one to be, that is, just to be informed. And that was one of the ones we got our participants to respond to, or the prompt that we gave to them when they were discussing children assenting. Now, the participants were 33 researchers. We sent out, I think, 135, chosen just by people going through research reports from various universities here and overseas and finding out researchers who were working with children under five. And from those names, we sent out 135 surveys. We got back 33, and they were a wide variety of people. It was good that a number of people who'd been working for many years with young children responded, and also some who'd only recently begun working with very young children and had bright new ideas. The representation came from arts, education, human movement, law, medicine, occupational science, philosophy, psychology, public policy, social work and sociology. And eight people agreed to participate in the individual interviews. Two of them came from UK, four from Australia, including one Indigenous Australian, one Ireland, and one from the US, from Boston. Now, the interviews we have yet to do, we're just organising them. Many of the people couldn't be involved until October. October, particularly overseas, seemed to be a good month to interview people. So the preliminary findings we've got here come not from the finalised product, but just from the actual survey. And one of the things which was interesting there was the wide recognition of the unequal power situation in research with very young children. And the way one understands power will depend on what sort of philosophical basis one has. So that we'll need to tease that out more in our final report. The second one, the stress on the importance of seeking continuing assent of the child throughout the research, was one which was stressed by almost everybody in the survey. So they didn't see just that initial ethics application as being the most important thing in having behaving ethically in the research with young children. It was how you continued that understanding of young children and that response to young children throughout the research. And that was reassuring. The importance of taking diverse cues from the behaviour of the child to assess their continued willingness to engage with the research. So the very young child has the right to withdraw from the research just as adults have. And how does one test that? How do you get that idea? Not just from words, but from other cues. The general rejection of the idea that in a designated research institute continuing assent can be assumed from initial consent. Now, that used to be fairly common in educational institutions in particular, where there was where one was designated as a research institute. It was argued that the parents knew it was an educational a research institute, so research could just go on without it being examined at every point of change. And that was rejected by a large number. And the much acceptance of the advantage of having a person not involved in the research to represent the interests of the child and support their participation or withdrawal. Now, that is something which I was a little surprised at too, because the idea of having an extra person who's not part of the research team but is there to represent the interests of the child is not something which many years ago would have been accepted. They'd get in the way, they'd keep on fussing over the child, etc. But this was pointed out by a number of people, agreed to by a number of people. And the final one there, general acceptance by those who agreed, who responded, and I've said it, and maybe this is not a fair sample, these are the ones who did respond, that this is an important and complex topic worthy of further research. There are many questions still to be raised and which we won't be, of course, giving final answers to. But one of the interesting things was the difference between the different disciplines. There was, I think, among all the disciplines, some knowledge of the sort of general principles of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. But there was a difference in the harm-benefit discussion. The ones from medicine saw themselves with the potential of doing a great deal more harm than the ones from education. I'm not sure, I think that could be argued, but it was still interesting. And the question about whether there's a new orthodoxy in research with children, and if so, what are the dangers of this? So there is almost all of the respondents to the survey came from this new paradigm, the paradigm of seeing children as active human beings who were active citizens, as some said, and therefore able to contribute to the research. But I'll just ask the question, there are there dangers as there are in any orthodoxy? How should we be challenging this? And the finally one there is the one to do with adult power. Seems very important with the with very young children. And you've got that tension there between the idea of protecting the very young child and allowing the child to participate. Thank you very much, and thank you to Ori for giving us the money that's made this possible too, and we look forward to continuing it and finishing it. Thank you.
Can I now invite our fifth presentation, which is from Dr. Kate Fox from the School of Physics and the Faculty of Science, who's going to talk to us about the ethical consideration for bionic eyes.
All right, so I come from physics. I'm actually an engineer hiding in physics, and I'm part of the Bionic Vision Australian Consortium, who was given $50 million by the Australian Government in 2010 to work towards developing a retinal prosthesis able to cure blindness. But of course, as an engineer, we have a kind of interesting opinion on ethics and compliance and that sort of stuff. But I do want to say that Bug Vision Australia takes ethics very, very seriously. Nothing we've done in the last 4 years hasn't been done without strict human and animal ethics guidelines. So when I saw this grant, I thought I'd go ahead with it, mainly from an engineer's perspective on how we interpret ethics, the research environment. And I did this in conjunction with Frederick Gilbert, who is an ethicist at the University of Tasmania, who has a long experience in medical ethics in relation to deep brain stimulation and brain interfacing devices. So as an engineer, we have a code. This is the IEEE code. I'm not going to go through it, obviously, but it basically tells us to do the right thing and act in the best interest of the community. But really, it comes down to our own personal moral compass. And some people obviously have a better moral compass than others, but I'd like to think that we're all pretty good. The devices we have at the moment, so we have three devices. On the left here is the prototype device. This is the one you would have seen in the media. As a high-profile Australian project, we've got a lot of media attention. But this device sits behind the retina, so inside the eye still, but not nearly as invasive as what another device would be. And the electrode count is very low. So you're looking at 24 electrodes in prototypes, working towards 44 and 98 as time progresses. But you've got to think that when we look, we have over a million pixels of vision. People who get these devices have 24. So there's a real mismatch in what us as able vision people believe this device can do versus what it can do for the blind community. The second device is an epiretinal device. So it sits inside the eye and it's much more invasive. It uses anchoring techniques to hold it in place, but it's got more electrodes because you're sitting a lot closer to the nerve cells you're trying to stimulate. This is a CAD showing you actually how invasive this second device is. So you're actually going through the eye wall. So you've got a lead hanging out inside the eye as it slowly turns. You'll see the device itself with the mechanical fixation. So retina is like a tissue paper. It's very weak. It's not held there by anything other than positive pressure. So anything that touches that retina will cause irreversible damage. Inside the device, you've got a chip and that sort of stuff. So when we look at bionics, what sort of stuff impact ethics? The media, the coolness factor. We've all seen the science fiction movies that tell us that Star Trek has, I can't remember this guy's name, Data something, the advisor anyway, who back in the 1970s had their own bionic eye. You look at the patient groups you're selecting. Are you selecting a weaker population? Replacement of body parts, replacing a body part, is that an okay thing? You know, so how broken does it have to be before you can walk in and replace it? Animal testing is also always a buzzword there. And what the long-term effects of society? The problem you have with bionic eyes in particular is that every person thinks they know what a bionic eye is. They've seen enough movies, they've seen enough media coverage. So you've already got this sort of softened opinion on what it can do. But if you strip back all the lessons you've learned, it may not be as foreboding as may first appear. Time magazine had a cover recently questioning the use of humans in human trials and sort of really playing up to people's perceptions on research. When we looked at our study, we did a lot of work in animals, as most research projects do. But because we've actually gone into clinical trials with three patients, we've had to go through very, very strict ethical guidelines through both university ethics committees, Australian government regulations, and FDA approval even. And our selection protocols have been very, very tight. But when we're selecting our people, you know, blindness is one of those things where you really can tap into a very needy population group because they're seeing it as this magic pill that can cure them of a lifetime of blindness. So you'd be very careful to manage your expectations. As I told you, 24 points of light does not equal the million that we would see as able vision people. So it's about managing expectation and reducing this preconceived perfect outcome. This may or may not work.